He left to go find Malia, and I went back to my seat and got on a conference call. When we landed, I rode in the motorcade to Obama's place instead of the staff hotel. The house had an enormous, high-ceilinged living room that was larger than my entire apartment. The Obamas went into an adjacent room to eat dinner with a small group of friends, and I went into an office where there were a couple of laptops and a printer. It was the kind of house where the sound system played in every room at the same volume. I sat there mustering every ounce of outrage to write a statement that would channel our national disgust toward ISIL, learning as much as I could about Jim Foley so I could compose a tribute to his life. I was sitting in a home that someone else had rented, listening to R&B that was playing for people in other rooms. I felt I could step out of myself and see myself sitting there. The effort it took to inhabit an awful moment like this. The absurdity of the setting. The question in my head that Anne would ask. Why does it always have to be you? By the time I was done and Obama had finished dinner, a collective judgment had been reached to make the statement in the morning. It was getting late, and we'd know more tomorrow. I met briefly with Obama. Before I left for the car ride back to the hotel, I called Dennis McDonough and put the phone on speaker on the coffee table in front of us. Clearly, whatever conversation had taken place at dinner included a discussion of whether Obama was entitled to a break. "What difference does it make whether I deliver the statement or we just put it out on paper tonight?" he asked. "People need to hear from you on this one, Mr. President," Dennis said. Obama looked at me. "They do," I added. "It's a big moment." Obama paused. He knew as well as we did that he needed to deliver the statement, but he felt his own, more pronounced version of the exhaustion I was feeling. It also went against his instinct to not inflate a terrorist group. "Okay," he said, standing up. "But I think this just elevates ISIL." "We understand, sir," McDonough said. The next morning, I heard nothing from Obama, but he showed up at the school where the press was assembled. Jen Palmieri had come up for the second week, and we spent a minute with him in an anteroom. He complained again about having to give the statement, a feeling that seemed to have hardened overnight. "It just elevates ISIL," he said. "It's exactly what they want." Still, he delivered the statement forcefully, but would end up being heavily criticized for playing golf that same afternoon. I didn't know how I could keep this up for two more years. By the end of 2014, I would have a new baby, and we would be done with our Cuba negotiation. It'd be a natural point to leave. I just didn't know if I could convince myself to go through with it. I told Anne, but despite all the sacrifices she'd made, she surprised me by encouraging me to stay. "If you leave," she said, "you'll regret it." My father had just undergone knee replacement surgery, and I took the train up to see him one day at the outpatient rehabilitation center where he was staying in White Plains. The place had the appearance of an early 20th century retreat, a stately campus of red brick buildings with an internal courtyard. We sat there making small talk, eating sandwiches. My dad told me about the steps he was planning to take to improve his diet and exercise. He was 68 years old when I went to work for Obama. He was now 74 and figuring out what the rest of his life would look like. I could tell he had missed seeing me. His first question when we were together was usually about the next time I could visit. But he also always asked with pride in his voice, "How's Barack?" On the train back to New York City, I took out my BlackBerry and saw a series of email chains debating whether Obama should hold a press conference that day. Some of the communications staff thought it was premature. We lacked good answers on ISIL or Ukraine. But McDonough and Palmieri were in a mode where they felt it was always better for him to be out there. Fresh off his vacation, he showed up in the White House briefing room wearing a tan suit, looking like a dapper game show host, which caused a stir. Peppered with questions about ISIL, he responded to one by saying, "We don't have a strategy yet," the kind of honest answer that gets a president into trouble. 6 years into my job, I didn't need to read the cycle of criticism popping up on my BlackBerry to know what it said. As if to rediscover some part of myself from an earlier time, when I read novels and wanted to write one, I was reading a new book by Haruki Murakami. The main character was exactly my age, 36. In the book, he finds himself paralyzed in his own life and looking to his past for answers. I thought about this short trip I was on. The setting was familiar. The New York streets, trying to make plans with old friends, sleeping in my old bedroom. But everything else was different. The things that I was thinking about, the world coming to me through my BlackBerry, the fact that my father was in a rehab center talking about aging. I could see myself in the present circumstance of the narrator, but not in any rediscovery of the past that I didn't know how to find. I was in the middle of a different story, and if I left my job, I wouldn't see it through to the end. A few days later, we flew to Estonia in an effort to show Russia that we would stand up for our easternmost NATO allies. When we landed in the early morning hours, I took a walk through the old part of Tallinn. The streets were empty, just the occasional person going to work, biking, selling flowers. Nestled on the Baltic Sea, Tallinn is a hybrid, with neatly arranged streets and an orderly lifestyle, but with hints of its giant neighbor evident in the Russian Orthodox churches that looked like mini Kremlins. There was a lingering unease, a palpable sense that the place was under threat. In a meeting, the Estonian president, Toomas Ilves, insisted to Obama that we had to take Putin at his word if he said he would take Kiev. Ilves had an academic manner, and he described methodically how Russia was using fake news and disinformation to turn Estonia's Russian-speaking minority against Europe. Speaking in paragraphs, he tied together Putin, the emergence of right-wing political parties in Europe, and ISIL. "These are people," he said, "who fundamentally reject the legitimacy of the liberal order. They are looking for another form of legitimacy, one that is counter to our notion of progress." After the meeting, I joined Obama for lunch and told him I thought Ilves did the best job I'd heard of tying these disparate threads together, explaining a theory of the forces at work in the world without having to rely on a construct that roots them all in American foreign policy. Without missing a beat, Obama said, "That's the same dynamic as with the Tea Party. I know those forces because my presidency has bumped up against them." He paused. "It's obviously manifest in different ways, but people always look to tear down an other when they need legitimacy. Immigrants, gays, minorities, other countries." Obama was more sanguine about the forces at play in the world, not because he was late in recognizing them, but because he'd seen them earlier. As an African American, he had an ingrained skepticism about powerful structural forces that I lacked when I went to work for him. After years of Mitch McConnell's obstructionism, Fox News's vilification, and growing tribalism at home and abroad, he had priced in the shortcomings of the world as it is, picking the issues and moments when he could press for the world that ought to be. This illuminated for me his almost monkish and at times frustrating discipline in trying to avoid overreach in a roiling world while focusing on a set of clearly defined priorities. Core interests and allies defended. Old accounts like Cuba closed. New agreements forged. Stupid shit avoided. Our values advanced by how we lived them. Change that is incremental but real. A few days after we got back to Washington, I went up to the Oval Office to go over a proposed outline of his upcoming speech at the United Nations. He went on at length, speaking with more passion than he had in a while, woken from his August funk. I heard Marine One landing on the South Lawn in the distance. I asked where he was going. He said he was going to an event in Baltimore to celebrate the bicentennial of the writing of the Star-Spangled Banner. "I've always been more of an America the Beautiful guy," I said. "Yes," he said, "but only if it's the Ray Charles version." That triggered a memory of 9/11. I told him about how my Queens neighborhood was filled with the funerals of cops and firefighters for days, widows sitting in lawn chairs surrounded by men in uniform. How I went to a small railroad bar near my apartment a few days later, and a burly guy stood next to me at the urinal before looking at me, his eyes welling up, and saying, "I can't even fucking piss." I told Obama, "I went home and sat on my bed and listened to Ray Charles singing America the Beautiful, and it was the first time after 9/11 that I cried." "You know," he said, "that should be the national anthem." I laughed. "They should play it before every game." "Seriously, think about it," he said, as if I had a say in the matter. "It's beautiful in a uniquely American way. It's all there. Black and white, religious and secular, glory and pain." With that, he started to sing the first notes. "Oh, beautiful for heroes proved," swaying, like Ray, from side to side. With that, he made the walk out onto the south lawn toward Marine One, leaving me alone in the Oval Office. I stood there in the middle of the carpet ringed with the quote from Martin Luther King about the arc of the moral universe, Ray Charles's voice pulsing in my head. There was no way that I was going to leave this job. Chapter 24. New Beginnings. Ricardo and I arrived in Rome around noon, time enough for us to get to the Vatican early and walk around the block a few times to process what we were about to do. Over the previous few weeks, Obama gave us clearance to authorize an exchange of the remaining three Cubans imprisoned in the United States for our intelligence asset and Alan Gross. We and the Cubans had agreed to announce the beginning of a process to normalize relations, including the establishment of diplomatic relations. The Cubans had agreed to release 53 political prisoners and expand access to the Internet. We had agreed to take steps to ease restrictions on travel and commerce with Cuba, within the confines of the embargo, which we could not lift without Congress. The Vatican does not do business on email, so all they knew was that we were coming with the Cubans to have a meeting. That afternoon, surrounded by pilgrims, tourists, and Romans, we tried to find the entrance where we were supposed to meet a man named Monsignor Murphy, an aide to Cardinal Pietro Parolin, the Vatican Secretary of State. Murphy found us at one of the gates. He was plainly dressed and spoke with a slight English accent. He was an English Murphy, he told us, not Irish, though many people made that mistake. As he walked us through the Vatican complex, he paused inside a stone courtyard and gestured toward a simple door. "That," he said, "used to be the Pope's front door." He had since moved to different living quarters. When we got to the meeting room, Alejandro surprised Murphy by greeting me with a characteristic bear hug. He asked about a story in Politico that said I was leaving the administration. I replied that he shouldn't make too much of it. "But it named three who are leaving," he insisted, "and you are one of the three." "I'm not leaving anytime soon," I said. "People like to gossip." We had a lengthy conversation about kids and the name Anne and I had chosen for our unborn daughter, Ella, which didn't translate easily into Spanish. It clicked when Juana, the Cuban interpreter, said excitedly, "Oh, like Ella Fitzgerald." We sat there making small talk, waiting to be summoned. The Cubans went in first, leaving Ricardo and me waiting. We chatted with Parolin's deputy, a kind, soft-spoken man named Monsignor Camilleri, who explained that he lived in Cuba for some years and was now working on improving the conditions for Christians in the Middle East. After about 45 minutes, it was our turn. Parolin was a Vatican diplomat with extensive experience in Latin America, and his face showed a degree of shock. "Normalizing relations?" he kept asking us to clarify. The purpose of these separate meetings, I realized, was to enable him to independently verify our respective commitments. He also seemed surprised at the role I played. At first, he addressed Ricardo, who looks a little older than I do, by my name. To clarify why we were the representatives there, Ricardo explained the role of the National Security Council in our system. I chimed in that we could be more discreet than the State Department. This seemed to trigger a question that was gnawing at him. "Does John Kerry know about this?" he asked. "Yes," I said. Earlier that summer, Susan Rice had given Kerry an overview of what we were doing. I assured him that Kerry was supportive. After about 30 minutes, we moved back into the larger room so that the American, Cuban, and Vatican representatives could be seated around an enormous wooden table in large red-backed chairs that felt as if they were made for some kind of Vatican council from the 17th century. Paroline sat at the head, with Alejandro and me flanking him, and read a statement that had clearly been prepared before he knew the full purpose of our meeting, alternating between Spanish and English. He welcomed us to Vatican City, saying it was just a small state in the community of nations, but one that held spiritual power. He thanked us for expressing confidence in the moral authority of Pope Francis, emphasized the Church's neutrality in affairs between states, and its commitment to seek peace among peoples. Then he seemed to go off the text in front of him. He looked at each of us intently. "Seeing you here generates hope, especially in the heart of the Pope," and he asked me to convey his greetings. I spoke first. To address any lingering concerns from Paroline, I said that we were there because our presidents had authorized this dialogue and that these commitments reflected their decisions. Then I read the first short document aloud, stating our mutual commitment to begin normalizing relations. I felt no nerves, just the satisfaction of having nothing left to do other than read what was printed in front of me. When it was Alejandro's turn, I let my eyes wander over his shoulder as he read the same words in Spanish. Behind him was a giant mural of the crucified Christ surrounded by attending angels. On another wall hung an imposing portrait of Benedict XVI, the conservative former pope who was living in self-imposed retirement. The image of the living Benedict seemed a reminder that there were more reactionary forces nearby, in Cuba, the United States, and around the world, forces that were still in the picture. We read several more documents in turn, memorializing our commitments and noting where we still differed. As we finished, we all agreed formally, in the presence of Paroline, to honor them. Alejandro then made a long speech. He said that this was a first step toward normalizing relations, and that as neighbors, the United States and Cuba should pursue dialogue. He noted irreconcilable differences between our systems of government, but said that they shouldn't stand in the way of cooperation that benefits our people. "Ben's daughter, Ella, and my children should be the immediate beneficiaries," he said, "along with other children in Cuba and the United States." "We have a difficult history," I replied. "We felt the full weight of that history in our talks. Our work together doesn't erase that history or our differences, but we recognize that we're neighbors and we're also family, given how many Cubans live in the United States. We're here today because our leaders have chosen to look forward. Despite our differences," I said, "we can agree on a basic commitment to human dignity, something that is central to the Pope's message and the mission of the Church." At that point, we were both out of speeches, but it seemed that neither of us wanted the meeting to end. Sitting there, as Paroline waited to see if there was anything else from either side, it felt so rare to inhabit a moment of purely good news. In front of me, the faces of angels on the giant mural held serene smiles. "I enjoy this moment," Paroline said, breaking the silence with a smile. "I thank God to be here able to do this. What you are doing is going to give people hope." Alejandro led us all in a standing ovation. Paroline went around the table shaking hands with each of us. He pulled me close and said, almost conspiratorially, that when we made the announcement publicly, there should be champagne. When we were led back outside by Murphy, it felt as if we had been inside for days. Ricardo and I walked out on our own, through the crowds, then out the gates, and anonymously into the eternal city of Rome, somewhat drunk with wonderment at what had just taken place. We held this secret a happy thing. This was no longer just some project we were pursuing, flying to Canada, haggling with the Cubans, working to get people's attention and approval back home. This was now something that was going to happen, that was going to exist in the world, and the emotions of the Vatican officials seemed to foreshadow the impact that could be unleashed by the announcement itself. We knew something that was going to send out ripples around the world. We went in search of the perfect, simple Italian meal. We walked for blocks and blocks, looking at restaurants and dismissing them as not quite perfect enough. Finally, we found a place near the river, with a table in the back, where we had buffalo mozzarella, prosciutto, artichokes drenched in olive oil, pasta with ragu, and a bottle of Chianti. For once, Ricardo didn't have his spiral notebook out. "For someone like me," he said, "this is as good as it gets." Sitting there, I felt 1,000 years removed from the anxieties that awaited me back in Washington. We had done something big and right for its own reasons. I had never felt so at home, so far away from where I lived. A few weeks later, the Democrats were beaten in the midterm elections, losing 13 House seats and 8 Senate seats. Unlike in 2010, when the losses cast a depressive weight on the White House, the feeling was different this time. Obama made a comment a few days after the election that would end up becoming our mantra for the next 2 years. "My presidency is entering the fourth quarter. Interesting stuff happens in the fourth quarter." Yes, it was a cheesy sports metaphor, but Dennis, who has something of the Midwestern high school football coach in him, embraced it. He had stickers made with Obama's mantra on them and started handing them out. This elicited some eye-rolling, but also a sense that perhaps we were going to spend the last 2 years of the presidency doing big things, unencumbered by the caution and exhaustion that had crept in at points over the last few years. Almost immediately, this shift became a reality. Obama expanded protections for undocumented immigrants who had come to the United States as children and their families. He flew to Beijing and announced a bilateral agreement to combat climate change. He had spent many months quietly coaxing the Chinese to make this announcement, aided by John Podesta and our climate negotiator, Todd Stern, appealing to the ambitions of the new Chinese president, Xi Jinping. On the plane leaving Beijing, Obama, who had spent 6 years methodically investing in clean energy, changing fuel efficiency standards, and enhancing environmental protections without congressional support, took note of China's ability to make a snap decision that could transform their economy. "They can send a signal and remake their energy sector," he said. "We can't even build an airport." He seemed looser and less burdened by the opposition he faced at home. At our next stop after China, an East Asian summit in Myanmar, Susan and I climbed into the Beast after another long day. Obama took out his iPad. "I've got a song stuck in my head," he said, and started playing it at top volume, something I'd never seen him do in hundreds of these limo rides. "Thrift Shop" by Macklemore. He and Susan started dancing in their seats, bobbing and weaving from side to side. "I'm going to pop some tags, only got $20 in my pocket." As I sat there uncomfortably, the stiff white guy listening to the white rapper, a smile frozen on my face, wondering what the two Secret Service agents sitting in the front of the limo were thinking. This, I thought, is a guy who is out of fucks. Back in Washington on December 10th, I went into Obama's office to get his guidance for the remarks he'd give on his upcoming Cuba announcement. "Start at the Cold War," he said, "and hook the duration of this conflict to the duration of my own life." I went back to my office, where I was supposed to meet with a Yazidi member of the Iraqi parliament. Beyond the routine of meetings, speeches, and press briefings, it felt as if my job was shrinking to a collection of long shots and lost causes. I was taking a brief break in my office when Anne called to say she'd gone to the hospital with high blood pressure. "Don't come right away," she said. "I'll call you if it's time." I hung up the phone and told Bernadette Meehan, who sat right outside my office, what she'd said. "Are you crazy? Get out of here." I drove to the hospital and jogged up to the maternity ward, where I found Anne lying in bed and beginning to go into labor. I sat on a couch with a plastic cover as one of the best-looking men I've ever seen came in to give Anne an epidural. We called him McDreamy. The nurse suggested we take a nap. For a couple of hours, I dozed, glanced at Anne, who was asleep, and texted updates to family and friends to make myself useful, people whom I'd barely been able to keep in touch with for years, who were full of congratulations and pressed for updates in a way that felt, to me, like forgiveness. A little after 1 in the morning, things picked up as Anne and the nurse and doctor went through the pattern of labor, while I sat there, feeling as though I was watching something that was at the same time transformative for us and totally routine in the workings of a hospital. After what felt like an eternity, Ella was suddenly there, all four limbs moving at once, full of life and motion in the nurse's hands. In less than a minute, Ella was cleaned and swaddled and deposited in my arms. It was just before 4 in the morning as I looked down at her closed eyes and felt the warmth of her body pulsing through the blanket. The nurse's shift changed and we were alone. Anne and I took turns holding her, fighting to stay awake, now a different type of unit, 3 people living in the world. After we were moved to a private room, the nurse came in around 10, and she and Anne were changing Ella's first diaper when my phone rang. I answered, and it was Obama's voice on the phone, the first I'd heard from outside the hospital. "She looks like you," he said. "Hopefully she'll end up looking more like Anne." I laughed. "Your life will never be the same." Anne asked who it was, and when I said the president, it seemed almost normal. 3 days later, I had to go back into the office to meet the team working on the Cuba announcement. Because the circle was so small, I was the only person who could write the remarks, brief the press, and make sure the various pieces fit together. When I walked through the gate and into the West Wing, it felt like visiting a place from my distant past, a high school or college reunion, and not the place I'd been going every day for the last 6 years. That night, I sat at the table in my apartment and wrote the speech in a few hours. "Today, the United States of America is changing its relationship with the people of Cuba." The words came easily. This was something I'd done, not just something I was writing about. The day before the announcement, I came in to join Obama's phone call with Raul Castro, the first such communication between U.S. and Cuban leaders since the Cuban Revolution. As we sat in the Oval Office waiting for the call to be connected, Obama looked at me, Susan, and Ricardo. "As Joe Biden would say, this is a big fucking deal," he said. "Señor Presidente," Castro declared, coming on the line. I recognized Juana's voice on the phone interpreting. After the greetings, Obama went through all the points we'd given him to make, which took nearly 20 minutes. When it was Castro's turn to speak, he joked that Obama hadn't come close to Fidel's record for speaking uninterrupted. Castro started reviewing the commitments of both sides. Then he went on a long tangent about efforts to sabotage the Cuban government over the years. As I sat on the couch, my forehead began to sweat as I watched the hands on the antique grandfather clock mark time. 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. I passed Obama a note saying that he could cut this off. He shook his head, covering the receiver with his hand. "It's been a long time since they've talked to a U.S. president," he told me. "He's got a lot to say." The call wrapped up with Castro inviting Obama to come to Cuba to go hunting. The thought of Obama hunting, anywhere, seemed far more improbable than a U.S. president visiting Cuba. There was one final thing that could have derailed what we were doing. The communications team had been planning to set up a lectern in the Roosevelt Room, a location that would put Obama in front of a giant portrait of Teddy Roosevelt charging up San Juan Hill, the moment, symbolically, when the United States initiated its de facto colonization of Cuba. We had them move it instead to the cabinet room. The next day, I went to work early. It was cold, and I had barely slept in days, but the secret had held. I awoke to a clutter of messages. Separate planes had taken off for Cuba to pick up Alan Gross and the intelligence asset. Notification had begun for different members of Congress and our administration. All of the pieces were now in motion. I sat at my desk and made some final tweaks to the statement that Obama would give when I got word that the plane with Alan Gross on board had taken off from Cuba. A corned beef sandwich, his favorite, ready in the galley, his wife, Judy, who had endured more than 5 years of separation, waiting for him. News started to break, and we did a press call. I'd done hundreds of these over the years, but now I was telling a story of the last year and a half of my life. When that was done, I walked back out into the cold to get some air and take a break by myself, before re-entering a world that now knew my secret. I went back inside and watched Obama speak on the small television mounted on the wall in my office. I'd attend no celebration, no victory party. I wanted to take care of business so I could go home to my daughter, who was still not a week old. Before Obama was even finished speaking, Anne gave me the greatest gift that I could have received when she sent me a photo her sister, Teresa, took of Anne holding Ella in front of the image of Obama speaking on television, the chyron below him reading, "Obama announces new Cuba policy. Obama, normalizing relations between our two countries, most sweeping change to U.S.-Cuba policy since 1961. This was, as Ricardo had told me in Rome, as good as it gets. Part 4. What Makes America Great? 2015 to 2017. Chapter 25. Tapping the Brakes. As we started the fourth quarter, Obama had the national security team that he wanted in place. Susan Rice, Lisa Monaco, and Susan's principal deputy, Avril Haines, a smart, diligent, and eccentric woman who combined the experience of having been the NSC's top lawyer, insisting on fidelity to the rule of law, with the operational background of having been deputy director of the CIA. Together, this team had constructed a counter-ISIL strategy and an emergency global effort that would stamp out the Ebola epidemic that had spawned fears of millions being killed around the world. Toward the end of 2014, the Senate Intelligence Committee released the summary of a 6,700-page report on the Bush administration's use of torture and rendition, detailing in stark terms the moral collapse of the United States government after 9/11. There had been a lengthy period of declassification, with our White House put in the position of mediating between a CIA reluctant to see information go public and a Senate committee that wanted as few redactions as possible. The day after the report was released, McDonough asked Obama if he felt the rollout of the report had gone okay. "Yeah," he said. "I thought it went fine. What did you think?" "I thought it went fine too," McDonough said. "I just wanted to make sure you were good." "You know," Obama said, "I think it's a chance for all of us to reflect on what fear can do to this place. We're not so different from the people who came before us, though I think we're right about more things." His tone was unusually formal. "If you want to know why sometimes I tap the brakes, that's why. We can't make decisions based on fear." "You're goddamn right," Biden said. "And we're lucky to have you." He reached out like an old pole and grabbed Obama's wrist. After the ISIL beheadings, there had been a limitless demand for Obama to take military action, to obtain some measure of vengeance. Fear, bordering on hysteria, seemed to project from cable television. At one event, a businessman pulled me aside, as if in confidence, and told me he'd hired a private security detail so that he wouldn't be beheaded on the streets of New York. At one point, in the midst of it all, Obama called me up to the Oval Office, as he did sometimes when he wanted to unburden his mind. We chatted a bit about the current state of our public line on ISIL. "You know," he said, "I can see how the Iraq War happened." What do you mean? People are so scared right now, he said. It'd be easy for me as president to get on that wave and do whatever I want. Instead, that fall, he had been more deliberate, commencing a limited bombing campaign in Iraq and Syria, and putting small teams of U.S. advisors on the ground to help organize the Iraqi and Syrian Kurdish forces who were going to start steadily retaking territory from ISIL. He placed strict caps on the numbers of these troops and on what they could do, prompting another series of complaints about Obama micromanaging the Pentagon. He didn't care. ISIL was a serious enough threat to warrant launching thousands of airstrikes, but he cringed when he heard the threat described as existential. ISIL had killed 4 Americans, a tiny fraction of those lost in Iraq and Afghanistan. It wasn't, as some of our critics roared, analogous to Nazi Germany, the same rhetoric Bush used after 9/11 when the government was authorizing torture. By the winter of 2015, a principal Republican attack on Obama was that he didn't refer to our enemy as radical Islam. Early in the administration, we decided to move away from the phrase global war on terror, believing that you can't wage war against a tactic, nor could you ever defeat it. We also generally avoided using the word Islam in describing the enemy because terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda wanted to cast themselves as a religious movement. After bin Laden was killed, communications were found in his compound in which he lamented that the absence of a religious name for Al-Qaeda allowed the West to claim deceptively that they are not at war with Islam. ISIL, the Islamic State, was addressing that challenge in their name and their declaration of a caliphate. Since most Republicans didn't want to call for more troops in places like Syria, their strategies often began with the assertion that they would identify the enemy as radical Islam, as if the clarity of this rhetoric would cause ISIL to crumble. The media constantly asked us about our refusal to do so. That February, we were hosting a summit on countering violent extremism, which would bring together experts and leaders from communities, largely Muslim ones, where there was a threat of radicalization. The absence of the word Islamic from the conference name kicked the issue up yet again in the press, and Obama called me up to his office. "Hey," he said, sitting behind his desk. "I didn't realize that we were being so politically correct in talking about Islamic extremism. I thought it was just some Fox News bullshit." He had just read a column by Thomas Friedman entitled, "Say It Like It Is, Lambasting Us for Not Saying We Were at War with Radical Islam." I stood there feeling a weakness in my legs. Had we spent months defending a position that Obama didn't care that much about? "I think it's the phrase radical Islam," I said, "that makes it sound like all of Islam is radical," he said, nodding. "I get that. But I don't have any problem saying this ideology is a problem in the Islamic world. We've pointed to all the times you've said that." I tried to think of an alternative phrase and then realized that that was the problem. "I think the issue that comes to Josh," I said, referring to our press secretary's daily press briefings, "is why we don't say that we're at war with radical Islam." I saw Obama registering the absurdity of the debate. It was often the case that these controversies, which migrated from fringe websites to Fox News to the White House briefing room, and then finally to columns by people like Tom Friedman, did not reach him until later in that process than the rest of us. So anything we do now would be a shift in our position. "Exactly," I said, "and attract more attention." "Yes," I said, "here and around the world." We were both silent for a moment. "So it's not on the level," he said. "It's not on the level." "Okay," he said, realizing that it was a domestic political issue and not really a matter of national security. "I'll talk to Josh and Dennis about it." We went ahead with the summit on countering violent extremism, announcing a series of measures to work with communities to combat the threat from ISIL, as well as other extremist groups, such as white supremacists. We announced common-sense, technocratic things to do, build ties between law enforcement and Muslim communities targeted by ISIL, recognize that violent extremism can take different forms. But politically, that only raised the temperature. Ted Cruz, gearing up for a presidential run, denounced Obama, who had waged war as commander-in-chief every day of his presidency, as an apologist for radical Islamic terrorists. I finally confirmed to Obama that I would stick it out through the end of the administration. I was standing in the Oval Office when he asked me, as he had 2 years ago, after the election, on Air Force One, if I wanted to take on an additional project, something like Cuba. "No," I said, "but I would like some things to change."
"What?"
he asked. "I'd like to work less," I said, "and see my family more." To give him a sense of what I meant, I added, "I'd like to get out of the day-to-day communications where I can. I don't want to be coming to work in late 2016 and still answering some criticism about why you're weak on ISIL." He laughed. "Neither do I," he said, "but I'm going to need you for Iran." We were entering the home stretch of negotiations with the Iranians, and the ferocity of opposition to the agreement, which didn't even exist, was building. In late January, Speaker Boehner put out a press release announcing that Netanyahu would be traveling to the United States at his invitation to address a joint session of Congress. We received no advance notice of this visit from either Boehner or the Israeli government. This type of interference in American foreign policy, a foreign leader invited to lobby the U.S. Congress against the policy of a sitting president, would have been unthinkable in 2009. But by 2015, Netanyahu had become almost a de facto member of the Republican caucus, and Republicans had abandoned any norms about working with a foreign government to undermine the policies of a sitting president. Congress was debating yet another Iran sanctions bill, a short-sighted and unnecessary piece of legislation that would have blown up the negotiations. Obama went before the Democratic caucus and gave a lengthy defense of the need to give John Kerry time and space to negotiate a nuclear deal. "This vote," Obama said, "is not a freebie. I need you on this." He told them again that he'd veto anything that put the negotiations in danger. I was meeting regularly with Democratic members of Congress to try to convince them that we were pursuing a good deal, one that would roll back the Iranian nuclear program and avert a war. This included a standing meeting with the Jewish Democrats in the House. These were occasionally raucous meetings, as we all talked over one another and debated the various intricacies of the Iranian nuclear program. How many centrifuges they'd have operating? What facilities they could use? What would happen to their heavy water reactor, which was on track to produce plutonium? Hours and hours talking about a deal that hadn't even been reached. Usually, I was on permanent defense, responding to various lines of criticism circulating on the Hill. After Netanyahu's speech was announced, the dynamic shifted. Suddenly, the Democrats were more annoyed at Netanyahu for interfering in our politics than at anything we were doing. I'd have these meetings in the Capitol, often right before or after the Israeli ambassador, Ron Dermer, a close Netanyahu confidant, was meeting with the same group. It felt as if we were sparring, getting ready for a bigger fight to come. A 10-day stretch in June encapsulated both the events that ensured Obama's presidency would be a historic success and the clouds that would hover over his legacy. On June 16th, Donald Trump announced his candidacy for the presidency. I watched as he rode down an escalator in the gold-plated lobby at Trump Tower, waving to an assembled crowd. He launched into a rambling, semi-coherent rant that sounded like a greatest hits version of Fox News' opposition to Obama and called Mexicans rapists. We didn't take it all that seriously. Trump was just a cruder expression of what we'd heard from Republicans for years, and it seemed he had little chance of becoming president. The next day, June 17th, a young white supremacist named Dylan Roof walked into a black church in Charleston, joined a Bible study group, and then opened fire, killing 9 people in a matter of minutes. At that time, Roof had killed more Americans than ISIL and added a particularly vile act of terror to the long list of mass shootings that had taken place during the Obama presidency, shootings that we felt powerless to stop with a Congress that opposed any gun restrictions. Privately, Obama lamented that he was out of words to express outrage at another shooting. "Maybe I'll just go and attend the memorial service," he said, "and not say anything." Then, on June 25th, we filed into the Oval Office for the morning meeting. While Obama was getting briefed, he was interrupted, which was unusual, and told that the Supreme Court upheld the ACA. Then he held his hand over his head and closed his eyes tightly, as if to say, "Give me a minute." We all applauded, stood up, shook his hand. After less than a minute, he sat down and asked us to continue the briefing. It seemed that a weight had been removed from his shoulders. On the 26th, more good news. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of same-sex marriage. The White House became a celebratory place, people embracing in the hallways, gay colleagues in tears at the news. Plans were made to light the White House that night in rainbow colors. Coupled with health care, it felt as if the outlines of a successful presidency were coming into focus. Obama had been up late the night before, rewriting the speech that he was slated to give in Charleston at a memorial service for the 9 people who'd been killed. Cody Keenan had done the first draft, but told me that Obama had rewritten much of it himself, choosing to anchor the speech in the concept of grace. In raw, handwritten prose, he addressed squarely the racial taboos that he often shied away from. The racism of the Confederate flag and the criminal justice system. The scourge of gun violence and the casual bias that leads people to call Johnny back for a job interview, but not Jamal. The need to examine what we're doing to cause some of our children to hate. As Cody took off on Marine One, he sent me a note that Obama had said something unusual. Perhaps if the Spirit moved him, he would sing Amazing Grace during his speech. That afternoon, I was working at my desk when the speech came on the White House television channel that played whenever the president was speaking. Over the course of the speech, I stopped to watch as he delved deeper into these subjects. As was often the case in black churches, he fell into a more rhythmic style, feeding off the crowd, a man far more welcome there than he had ever been in Congress. "God has visited grace upon us, for he has allowed us to see where we've been blind," Obama said. "He has given us the chance, where we've been lost, to find our best selves. We may not have earned it, this grace, with our rancor and complacency and short-sightedness and fear of each other, but we got it all the same." It felt as though he was speaking directly to all of the conflicting emotions about America that I'd come to feel, the disappointment in the reality around me, but also the redemptive nature of the project that we were all a part of. As Obama neared the end of the prepared text, he described the dignity of the victims, the grace in their lives that could heal the hate in America. "If we can tap that grace," he said, "everything can change. Amazing grace. Amazing grace." I froze. Obama stopped talking and put his head down. I stared at the television. He paused for what felt like an eternity. The African-American clergy behind him sat in prayerful silence, draped in purple vestments. It felt as though he'd reached the end of one kind of speech, a particularly good one, but something was not yet fully expressed. Then something changed in his face. A face I had stared at and studied across 1,000 meetings. A face I had learned to read so I could understand what he was thinking or what he wanted me to do. I saw the faintest hint of a smile and a slight shake of the head as he looked down at the lectern, a letting go, a man who looked unburdened. "He's going to sing," I thought. "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound." The pastor behind him let out a joyful laugh. The audience began to cheer, springing to their feet, released from some more passive form of mourning. "That saved a wretch like me." The voices of the other congregants started to rise in unison with his. One of the preachers behind him opened into the largest smile that you could ever have at a memorial service, a wistful smile. Obama's body relaxed into the moment, his imperfect singing voice mining the depths of the hymn. I once was lost, but now I'm found. I started to feel everything at once. The hurt and anger at the murder of those 9 people. Another thing that I'd kept pressed down in the constant compartmentation of emotions that allowed me to do my job. The stress that came from doing a job that had steadily swallowed who I thought I was over the last 8 years. The more pure motivations to do something that felt right, buried deep within me. The sense that maybe we were all going to be okay, even if the world wasn't. Was blind, but now I see. An organ was playing. People were giving praise in the audience, and in that instant, I was reminded that there were people, good people, kind people out there in the world, who were more important than any of the petty controversies that enveloped us every day. People who understood who Obama was and what he had been trying to do. People whose support could allow him to stand there in the middle of his 7th year as president and be totally open in a way that I had almost never seen him be in public before. It was always hard to explain what it was that I most admired about this complicated man. Watching him, I felt that I would never have to explain it to anyone again. He then started reciting the list, punctuated by organ chords, of the names of every one of the victims, a stratagem that managed to do something I had never seen before, as the entire life of each person was celebrated, vindicated, and elevated by the short, declarative words that he spoke. Clementa Pinckney found that grace. Cynthia Hurd found that grace. Susie Jackson found that grace. Ethel Lance found that grace. DePayne Middleton Doctor found that grace. Tywanza Sanders found that grace. Daniel L. Simmons Sr. found that grace. Sharonda Coleman Singleton found that grace. Myra Thompson found that grace. Then it was over. This moment that had opened up a window into something, into Obama, into a better America than the one I lived in every day, into a purer sense of what we were all doing as people who worked for him. What we were a part of, what kept me coming back to work all these years. I sat at my desk, the White House feed on my television now an empty blue screen, and for the first time in many years, I sobbed. A few days after the Charleston speech, I went up to the Oval Office. It was the last meeting of the day, and Obama wanted to talk to me, Dennis, and Anita Decker Breckinridge, now his deputy chief of staff, about the potential rollout of an Iran deal. When the three of us walked in, instead of getting up and walking over to his chair as he normally would, Obama sat at his desk, lingering over a letter. He didn't offer his customary, "Have a seat," or acknowledge our presence. So the three of us stood over the couches awkwardly. People who saw Obama as much as anyone, but still deferential to the protocols of his office. "Dear Mr. President," he began to read aloud, "I used to not like you because of the color of your skin. My whole life I have hated people because of the color of their skin. I have thought about things since those 9 people were killed, and I realize I was wrong. I want to thank you for everything you were trying to do to help people." He finished and put the letter down. None of us knew what to say. It felt as if the whole presidency was for the purpose of receiving this single letter. He looked at the letter on his desk as though it were another person in the room. "Grace," he said. Then he got up and walked over to his chair. "It's a shame," he said, sitting down, "that those 9 people had to die for that to happen." Chapter 26. The Anti-War Room. Barack Obama took office after Iran had the scientific knowledge and infrastructure necessary to build a nuclear weapon. By the time we reached the interim agreement in 2013, they were less than a year from producing enough of the raw materials for the purpose if they chose to break out and pursue it. Therefore, the negotiations became an extended effort to solve a pressing scientific problem. How can we impose enough restrictions on Iran's nuclear program to prevent them from approaching that tipping point? Given the nature of the challenge, in addition to John Kerry, an increasingly important member of our negotiating team was Ernie Moniz, the nuclear physicist who served as our Secretary of Energy, a brilliant, unusually plain-spoken scientist with unkempt gray hair combed back in a style that made him resemble one of America's founding fathers. As the negotiations intensified into the spring of 2016, we inched closer to a deal. That is when my role became more pronounced. Because I was responsible for leading the effort to secure the congressional support necessary for an agreement to survive, I became a kind of barometer. In meetings or video conferences with Kerry and the negotiating team, Obama would glance at me as they reported the latest progress or backsliding, looking to see if I cringed or lit up at the latest report. I was familiar with the attacks that would come our way, in part because I was already hearing them. Obama had to balance security, science, and politics. For example, we had consistently opposed Iran having any centrifuges at Fordo, a site buried deep underground and therefore a harder military target. The Iranians wanted to keep some centrifuges there, but disconnected, with electronic seals in place to make sure they were off. In exchange, they'd make additional concessions on other issues. "Ernie, what do you think?" Obama asked. "Substantively, it makes no difference," he replied, adding that he'd rather have other Iranian commitments on their stockpile and ability to build new reactors. Satisfied, Obama would ask me if we could make that shift. "As long as we can say there's no enrichment at Fordo," I said. Kerry and Moniz flew to Vienna in late June to see if they could close the deal. Obama told Kerry that he had to be willing to walk away. "John," he said, referring to the victories on health care and same-sex marriage, "I've already got my legacy. I don't need this." Kerry said he understood, but he was also after his own legacy. He'd spent hundreds of hours in negotiations with the Iranians and built a close relationship with the Iranian foreign minister, Javad Zarif. Moniz had also developed a close relationship with his Iranian counterpart, who had attended MIT while Moniz was teaching there, before the Iranian Revolution opened up the chasm between our two countries. These were the two relationships that were going to have to get us over the finish line. Kerry and Moniz ended up spending 17 days in Vienna, capping off years of work. There is simply no way the Iran deal would have gotten done without both of them. Most of the final questions had to do with how long the different restrictions on Iran would last. It was a complicated process, with some restrictions lasting 8 years, some 10, some 15, some forever. Every day, Obama was updated. Multiple times a day, I'd check in via video conference with the team in Vienna, who had barely slept for weeks. We were holding out in Washington for things that often made little substantive difference, but could help us defend the deal against the barrage of criticism that was coming. Complicating matters was the fact that Congress had passed the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act, which required a congressional vote on a final deal within 30 days of its being submitted to Congress. We initially resisted this, but Democrats had grown weary of blocking Iran sanctions bills and thought it would be awkward to block an effort to call a vote. Here is what this meant in practice. Republicans needed a majority in the House and 60 votes in the Senate to formally reject the Iran deal. If we had enough votes to sustain a presidential veto in either the House or Senate, then they wouldn't be able to kill the deal. If we could secure 41 votes in the Senate, then Congress wouldn't even be able to reject it at all. Everyone knew that the review period would offer a forum for Republicans, the Israeli government, and AIPAC to attack the deal. Given the protracted negotiations, We missed a July 9th deadline that Congress had set in the legislation, which meant that the review period before a vote would be 60 days instead of 30. This would make it harder to secure congressional support, as the review period would now run through the August congressional recess, making it possible for critics